Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies Podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Graham Meikle, Professor of Communication and Digital Media at the University of Westminster in London.
and Prof G. It's great to see you. We've been gossiping for a quarter of an hour, which I very much enjoyed and learnt from, as is always the case when I engage with either your writings or with you as a person. It's a great honor that you're with us, and I appreciate it. And I wanted to ask you to begin matters by inquiring about what's currently dynamizing, retarding, informing, interesting, preoccupying you.
Yes. Well, I think all of those things, dynamizing, retarding, preoccupying, all of those things are the ways in which I'm currently thinking about, or currently responding to, the ways in which questions of AI and synthetic media and generative media have very, very suddenly become almost taken for granted, right? They've begun to establish themselves in daily life with kind of remarkable rapidity. And I'm concerned that for those of us who study media and communication and culture, I'm concerned that we find ways of bringing these things into our areas of interest and expertise rather than having to chase after what scientists are doing.
That's, I think, a really, really valuable point, because thinking about these questions again and again, I'm seeing lawyers, artists, and above all, scientists and so-called technologists being consulted about these things. And very rarely do I hear people like yourself being invited to comment as experts. And I think this is not just a problem to do with these new generative media, to use the term you just deployed, but more generally. And has it got something to do, Prof, with the status of these academic fields in within and outside universities in the Anglo world, do you think?
Certainly in the Anglo world, media studies, cultural studies, communication studies, continue to battle against a kind of reputational problem. In the UK context, media studies remains, as it has been for decades, remains the kind of the go-to whipping boy for a politician who wants to make an argument about low-value university courses. So there may be something in that. But also I think we need to be, as scholars of this stuff, I think we need to be more assertive about claiming things like AI and synthetic media as being very much within our sphere of expertise and concern. I mean, these things are about new ways of making meanings, right? And they're about challenges to settled understandings of how meanings get made and who gets to make them. So I think they're very, very much part of the sphere of expertise and concern and interest of scholars of media and culture. What I see a bit of that concerns me is people from the humanities and social sciences going towards other fields of expertise, and kind of implicitly acknowledging other disciplinary areas as the rightful home of this stuff that we are only engaging with because of, some spirit of interdisciplinarity, whether intrinsic or enforced by institutions. I mean, I had a someone asked me at an event last year, what kinds of things should we be studying as communication scholars, and what should we not be studying? And my answer to what should we not be studying was immediately I said central heating, right? And I meant that more or less literally, right? That there is a real tendency I'm seeing with men, yeah, many people, to engage with technological discourses from very, very different realms to our own. Perhaps because there's a sense that that might be where the money is. So I don't think we should be studying central heating. And by that, I mean that as a metonym for technological systems that are really not concerned with the production of meaning or with stories and images and ideas and songs. But we should be engaging with how these technological developments come onto our turf as scholars of meaning and ideas and texts, right, and culture. And we should be more assertive in claiming those things.
I appreciate that insight, and the question is how to go about it. I mean, in an area like the United States, communication studies has very particular geographical moorings and has largely been regarded as the degree that people on college sports scholarships do because it doesn't require much, rightly or wrongly. In terms of its public image via politicians or journalists, it doesn't really have one. It doesn't get condemned in the way that it experiences in the UK, I think. But it doesn't have a standing of legitimacy and importance. It doesn't have any auratic quality. So I guess one issue is how one can gain that auratic quality institutionally. And that's complex. In Britain, it probably means what perhaps is happening, which is a slow takeover from English as a go-to textual subject. It probably requires significant uptake at Oxbridge and Edinburgh and some of the other major, conventional places of real knowledge. And it probably needs some graduates becoming politicians. Whereas so many of them are politics, philosophy, and economics from Oxbridge, or doctors or lawyers or whatever it might be. So that's my sense. In any event, Prof, touching on this question of these synthetic media and so on, you have a fairly recent book out, which I have not been able to get hold of. So I apologize to you and listeners for not having read it, but about what in this year of elections, this year that has an unprecedented number of
That's right.
democracies holding elections, must be and is a key worry, and that is the deep fake. Could you clue us in onto into the book, but also very basically, what are deep fakes?
Hey, deep fakes are examples, the most prominent examples so far of synthetic media, media images and texts and audio and video that have been either created or have been very substantially altered using artificial intelligence techniques, specifically deep learning. Which is the deep in deep learning is the deep in deep fakes, right? It's a portmanteau term. But I think it's having begun by saying that, it's important to immediately qualify that and say that there is a spectrum here, that it's important in seeing the rise of synthetic, artificial, or flat out fake media material, it's important that we don't get hung up on a specific technical process, right? And say, ah, this is about generative adversarial networks, right? Because there's a spectrum here where you can go from very, very sophisticated CGI technology in Hollywood to Snapchat filters on your phone, right? There's a very, very broad spectrum for editing and amending and manipulating and remixing media material now. Deep fakes tends to be the name given to imagery which presents real or established or identifiable people in context, saying and doing things that they have never actually said or done. I became very interested in this about 5 years ago, 4 years ago. I wrote the book during the kind of the lockdown phase of COVID in 2020, 2021. And when I first started wondering, what are these phenomena? What are the same question that you asked me, what are deepfakes and how do they work and why do they matter? I imagined at first that it was what I was going to be researching was, as you framed it there, kind of electoral disinformation and risks to the integrity of votes and manipulation of people's perceptions around political events and campaigns. Actually, what I found very quickly was that so far there had been relatively little of that. And by far the biggest and most elaborate use of these technologies was in non-consensual sexual imagery of celebrities. That was by far, it still is by far the biggest use to which these technologies are being put. So that was immediately surprising to me. Although perhaps it shouldn't have been, right? Because whenever people get their hands on new means of communication, porn is pretty much the first thing that people are going to use it for. So perhaps I was naive not to go in expecting that. That's still a massive area of concern. I think that's For me, that's a bigger area of concern than the risks to elections, because what we're seeing is as the tools for making and circulating these kinds of imagery become more accessible, more familiar to people, easier to use, it's no longer just the Scarlett Johansson's and Taylor Swift's of the world who are being victims of this kind of thing, but ordinary women, non-celebrity women, are increasingly being targeted by people making and sharing non-consensual sexual imagery of them. And I should say, it is almost invariably women. I have seen very, very few examples of fake celebrity porn involving male figures. That says something about the kinds of communities that are making and sharing this stuff. But it also says something about the way that the technology is being developed, because it's technically much more difficult to make a non-consensual sexual image of a male figure, because the data sets and the software have been trained on archives of bodies of women, images of women. So a lot of the tools simply don't work on male figures. So that's a big part of the book. I also, as I said earlier when we were talking about how I think it's important that we try to bring things like this, developments in artificial intelligence and applications of machine learning tools, that we try to bring this into our area as people who study the productions of meanings and the productions of texts. So in the book, I also try to set examples of that. There are a lot of artists using these kinds of tools for satirical effect, for artistic exploration, and for resurrecting the dead. Actually, there's been a lot of interesting experiments in bringing back the dead through these technologies. So one of the things I've tried to do in the book was to situate this kind of thing in longer term kind of cultural contexts around people taking advantage of the creative potential of new technologies to explore new ways of making meanings. I develop a comparison in the book between some of the things that people are trying to do for satirical effect with synthetic media, with Berlin Dada 100 years ago, where the comparison or the analogy I found was that with the Berlin Dada period moment and the development of photomontage and satirical photomontage, that was in part a response to the new availability of photographic images, right? For the first time, photographs were everywhere and were accessible and cheap, right? There were more and more, they were in magazines and newspapers. So they were an available resource for people to play with in making meanings. 100 years later, what we're finding with some of the more some of the more experimental approaches to synthetic media is again about the new availability of new forms of imagery, right? So what I think is interesting is that deepfakes and synthetic media, they're not just some weird niche thing happening off to the side in the current media environment, which is how I find people often think of them. I think they're very, very central to a contemporary media environment in that they are made possible by social media. They're a logical extension of social media. For almost 20 years now, billions of people have been unwittingly creating these vast data sets. Right, we have shared countless billions of images and texts and videos and opinions and emotions and thoughts and cries for help and all of that. And without our realizing it, these have become massive data sets that people can use to train systems for manipulating these to analyze, to classify, and ultimately to use them to recreate things. So there is an analogy there that I think between the ways in which artists and others have responded to the new availability of media resources and the ways in which that is happening now.
And of course, this relates, as do all these technological advances you've mentioned, to intellectual property. Already, we're seeing complexities over works of art of different kinds created primarily through artificial intelligence and their owners, in inverted commas, or artists seeking copyright and initially being rebuffed, but now perhaps being accepted. And as usual, what happens in the United States will become the norm everywhere, I suspect.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, questions of intellectual property are very much front and center in these debates, and in some ways, I think that's right. I mean, by right here, I mean they should be. But I'm less concerned about, say, the rights of Warner or Marvel or Disney or somebody, right? Than I am about the everyday user, the everyday citizen online whose life is being turned into a text. I just mentioned this phenomenon whereby for 20 years now, people have been sharing and distributing and communicating every element of our daily lives. So we've gone from 15, 20 years ago when everybody suddenly thought it was fun to be on Facebook, sharing our address books, sharing our photo albums, sharing our likes and dislikes, and which movies we've seen, all of that. And how gradual, well, not even very gradually, quite quickly, we've seen the digital platform industries start pushing us to share more and more details of our lives. It's no longer enough just to have people's photo albums and address books. Now you also have to have their step counts and their hormone cycles and their blood alcohol levels and how do they drive, right? Which direction do they like to face when they sit down on the train? How fast are you walking right now? This kind of rapacious appetite for collecting ever more intimate data through, the networked sensors in your phones. This this is valuable to people because it is information that has never been mediated before, right? It's a new arena for the expansion of collection of people's personal information. And what one of the outcomes of this that we can see with the development of these generative AI or synthetic media systems is that all of this material, the raw stuff of the ever more intimate data of people's daily lives, as it has been expressed through the daily behavior that is captured by platforms, becomes the raw material, becomes the text. We are now the stories that are being kind of remixed and manipulated, and the stories that are being told. So when we think about intellectual property, what I'm concerned about is that we are all becoming intellectual property.
Property. And really, it's platform privacy that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And in many cases, we've colluded in our own oppression by providing data without seeing it as data.
Yes. Yeah. We didn't. Nobody saw it coming, right? A line I used, I think, in the deepfakes book, or possibly in a more recent one about social media, is that it's not that we are reduced to other people's data. It's not that we're reduced to our data. It's worse than that. It's that we're reduced to other people's data.
One of the things that interests me is that 20 years ago in the United States, when I talked about these things, people only cared if it meant the state learning about them. And they
Yeah.
didn't care when I told them that the end user licensing agreements that they engaged in order to play multiplayer online games saw them losing the rights to their own creativity. It doesn't matter, I don't care. Now, people seem in the United States, when I was last teaching there a couple of years ago, much more alert to this as a commodifying private push. They're still worried about the state knowing them, in inverted commas, but they're just as worried, at least this is anecdotally my experience, about corporate America knowing them. And I'm very hopeful about that. When I was in the days when one used to get phone calls from companies asking one's opinion of a product, opinion of an ad jingle, which I got not as a so-called expert, but as a member of the public, I would always say, "How much are you getting paid to ask me? Who's paying?
Yeah.
And what are you going to pay me?" Smart aleck, smart ass stuff, I understand. But really important to realize we're part of a commodity chain, which I think is what you're driving at.
I remember those calls. We don't get them anymore, I guess, because we
No.
have landlines, right? But I remember, and they would always frame those market research calls by they would preempt your question, or they would answer your question about how much are you going to pay me by saying, "Well, you get to give your views and opinions," as if it's like, it's you're doing it for exposure, right? You get paid later.
Well, the whole of public opinion polling's had to change because of the end of the landline, which may well come back, depending on what happens with climate change and other developments. When there's a major earthquake, your cell phone's not going to work. Your landline probably will.
Interesting.
That's why whenever I live in California, I get a landline. Anyway, Prof, onto the new book, which again I haven't read. I've read the earlier ones, but not these two, which is a second edition of your pathbreaking social media book. The first edition I have got from about 2016. You were just saying to me that you've changed probably 50% of it in the new edition, which I think you said came out only last week.
Yes, that's right. It came out on, 3 days ago.
3 days ago. Are
So
you more or less optimistic slash pessimistic about social media than you were when you
that
wrote
is
the
the first
first edition?
edition. I am more pessimistic than I was. The first edition of the I originally wrote this book in about 2015, I think. And it came out early in 2016, Right, so here's a book about the social media landscape, social media environment coming out in early 2016, right before Brexit, right before Trump, right before Cambridge Analytica, and before all kinds of other phenomena which have reshaped the social media landscape. The book was before TikTok, it was before Me Too, it was before generative AI, it was before Elon Musk got his hands on what used to be Twitter. Right. So that landscape has been completely reshaped and redrawn. So the challenge was, does the analysis and does the framing of social media around being essentially about the convergence of public and personal communication, right? And about the weird things that happens when these two things happen in the same space. Could I still apply that frame to today's landscape? And I think actually the book is more successful in that than the first edition was. I think that works very well. If, I'm going to have to say so myself because you haven't had a chance to read it yet, right? But I am not more optimistic than I was. I mean, I opened the book with several pages about Elon Musk's early takeover of Twitter. The section is called Elon Musk's Naked Lunch. And it's about how the concept there is, of course, that Burroughs once explained the meaning of the title Naked Lunch by saying it's about that frozen moment when everybody suddenly sees what's on the end of the fork. And I think with Musk's takeover of Twitter and the quite rapid deterioration of that service into something, into kind of a dark mirror of its earlier self, we do have that kind of frozen moment where everyone sees what's on the end of the fork. And to a large extent, it's us, right? We're what's on the end of that fork. With his $44 billion, he didn't just buy the brand, he didn't just buy the tech stack, he didn't just buy the bragging rights or the archive. He bought 15, 17 years of data about hundreds of millions of people, about who they know, what they like, what they think about, what they say. And this connects with what you were saying before about how people used to worry about government surveillance and were quite used to be quite okay about the idea of targeted advertising. 15 years ago, you'd have people say, "I don't mind if Facebook give me targeted ads. I'd rather read about, the concert in my area I might want to go to than about dog food, right? When I don't have a dog." What we could see in the end of Elon Musk's fork is the real question about these data archives that we're colluding and creating is who will own that data in 10 years' time, right? And what might they do with it? So one of the things that's noticeable about all the big platforms at the moment, about Facebook, about Google, about Amazon, Microsoft, all of the Chinese-backed corporations as well, is they're all looking for and finding ways of moving into healthcare, right? Moving into the health sector because health is, among other things, a data sector, right? And it's one with kind of limitless potential for commercial expansion if you have access to data resources on the scale of Meta or Amazon or Apple, right? So I think we should be very concerned about the question of who might own this data in 10 years' time, particularly if you're in a country like the US, where the healthcare system is so commercialized already. It's not paranoid to imagine a scenario in which Facebook is suddenly, a leading health insurance company, and they have access to all kinds of information from the last 20 years of your life that you might not have wanted to share with an insurer.
Yeah, absolutely. So you were more optimistic 10 years ago than you are today. What you've described is a process of commodification of people's everyday lives
Yes.
rather than the freedom to express themselves in public that has hitherto been denied. I think that's more or less what you're outlining for us.
Yes. Yes, I mean that freedom to express yourself in public is very much still there, but I think it's increasingly tempered by the knowledge that if you say things, people might be listening, and the audience is always unknowable. I do think that it's. I think on the one hand, you do have to you do have to face up to the reality, and it's very visible now. The reality that these platforms are rapacious commercial data mining operations. But at the same time, platforms like Facebook, like YouTube, like TikTok have brought billions of people the capacity to communicate with others, to find community, to find communion. So to analyze these things today, I think you need to navigate between these two poles. You have to acknowledge the pleasures and benefits that they bring, while recognizing that they're not a public service. They're not there to improve your life, no matter what the mission statements say about creating, giving you the power to share and making everyone more globally connected. Part of the issue here is just the term social media, which started as a, as far as I can establish, began as a marketing slogan, right? It was a way of branding certain developments around the turn of the century. And as scholars, we had to find a way of repurposing or retrofitting this slogan into an analytical tool or a way of making sense of what was happening. But it's such a seductive label, right? Social media. I remember The Onion 15 years ago had a video of some kind of young tech guy standing up to do like a TED talk to this room full of people in suits. And he just stands there and he looks at them and he takes his time and he says, "Social media," and gets a 2 minute standing ovation, and that's the whole video, right? Because it's a very appealing term. But really, they're not media companies at all. Not in the sense that we understood those in the 20th century, where a company like Disney or an organization like the BBC, we could think of them as media companies because they were in the business of producing and circulating ideas and images, stories and songs, information and entertainment. They were text platform, text companies. These guys don't do that. If Facebook is a media company, it's a company that doesn't actually produce any media, right? Actually, it's a data company. And if we were approaching them as data com talking about them as data companies all the time, I think that might start to shift people's perception of actually what they are.
This relates to another topic of yours, another book that you've written about a phenomenon that is not being discussed so much at the moment because AI is the current fetish, but I think may turn out to be more important, which is the Internet of Things. And the Internet of Things is, in a sense, the obverse of artificial intelligence, in that it is the moment when the seemingly ephemeral digital immaterial becomes precisely the material, the real, the tangible. Could you, if I'm right, tell us why the Internet of Things ceased being a fetish,
Cease being a fetish.
and whether it will come back, and how you look back on that book?
Okay, yeah, well, thanks for this. I haven't spoken about this book in a while. So this is a
Well,
book.
there's a reason why, old boy.
Oh, well, we'll get to this. This is a book called The Internet of Things, which I co-wrote with my friend and former colleague, Mercedes Burns, who's now a professor of digital cultures at King's College London. We were very in, we're still we still are very interested in what this term meant and how it was being sold to people. In the book, we argue that We argue against the idea that the Internet of Things is the kind of the extension of the internet into more or less novelty devices, right? If you say the Internet of Things to people immediately think, ah, fridges, right? The fridge that's going to text you a selfie of its contents to remind you to buy milk, or that will go ahead and order the milk on its own. I mean, those things have actually been available since the turn of the century without ever finding a market, really. And that's because they're deeply stupid and undesirable objects. But in the book, we describe this as the fridge fallacy, the idea that the Internet of Things is just about adding network connectivity to household appliances. I had a lot of fun writing sections of that book where I tracked down the most absurd examples that I could. The Bluetooth enabled umbrella, that will text your phone to let you know that it's raining, the frying pan with an app, the sofa with an app. There was one from Spain, where I believe you are at the moment, Toby, where a company was marketing a mattress fitted with sensors, and these were impact sensors. So it was being marketed as a device to for people concerned about marital infidelity, that the bed would actually the mattress would alert the user with a message on their phone if it detected somebody impacting the sensors in the mattress at an unexpected time of day. Now, these things are absurd, right? They're completely ridiculous. But the core, actually, of what the Internet of Things is about taking sensors, that example of impact sensors, right? Location sensors, moisture sensors, ambient sensors, noise sensors, light sensors, and connecting those to networks in order to generate, circulate, and enable the analysis of ever more data. Right. So the Internet of Things did not go away. The Internet of Things is right inside your phone right now. That's what your phone is. It's an assemblage of sensors, from the ones that wake it up, from the ones that confirm you are who you are, from the ones that track your footsteps, for the ones that you enable to respond to patterns of light and movement and heat and noise. It's a package of sensors designed to collect and circulate data about you. And because your device is identifiable, then so are you. So networked sensors have very much not gone away. They're actually more prominent and more pervasive than they were at the time we wrote the book 8 years ago. What has gone away is the term the Internet of Things. And I would say that we anticipated that in the book. We anticipated that the term itself was kind of faddish. You used the word fetish, which is quite nice. We actually wanted to call the book Sensing Networks, but the publisher preferred the Internet of Things because they felt there was a market niche for that. In the book, we kind of anticipated the perhaps transience of the phrase the Internet of Things, by referring to an idea I've always really liked from a guy called Mark Weiser, who you might recall was a scientist at Xerox, who was very influential in developing the concept of ubiquitous computing. And in, I think, 1991, there or thereabouts, he wrote an article in Scientific American in which he said that, I can more or less quote this from memory, but roughly he said, the most profound technologies are those that disappear. They weave themselves into everyday life until they become indistinguishable from it. Now, I always thought that was a really, really good insight, because by disappear, he didn't mean they kind of go away in the way that perhaps the internet fridge is going to go away. He meant, I think, things like electricity. which disappear in the sense that you stop noticing it, right? You only notice electricity if the power goes off or you get your bill, right? But otherwise, it's become invisible. And I think that is what has happened already with kind of network sensors. So I'm proud of that book. I think Mercedes and I did, we identified something that there was a moment there where something that was happening. And we tried to say, this is the moment to notice this stuff before it, as Wiser has it, disappears, before it fades, but weaves itself into the background of everyday life. So yeah, I thought that was a good book. And I think it fits in a neat little line in books that I've written, or in that case, co-written, in the last 8 or 10 years. Because the social media book, in both its incarnations, is about that question of sharing, right? Sharing first photo albums and address books and so on. The Internet of Things book is very much about what I spoke about earlier, about how it's no longer enough for platforms to have access to your address books and photo albums, but they want your blood alcohol level and your step count and your sleeping patterns as well. That was very much that networked sensors moment. And this leads into the deepfakes book, which is one logical, deepfakes are one logical extension of this kind of data capture, right? It's like, we've got this archive of stuff now, let's manipulate it.
Prof, I'd like to conclude by asking you two last questions, if I may,
Yeah.
and then throwing it back to you for you to add anything to what you've already said on a topic you've already discussed, or to add something new. Does that sound all right as a way of bringing things to a close?
Absolutely.
Okay. First question, something that is very much in the air at the moment and has been a concern of yours for a long time, and that's social movements. One of my concerns goes back to Tom Lehrer, one of his songs where he refers to the Spanish Civil War and says, we may have lost all the battles, but we have all the good songs. And my concern that just as the Republican Party can no longer claim to be the party of law and order when it's clearly the opposite, so lots of the politics of spectacle adorned by, incarnated in, and adored by the progressive left, in double inverted commas, has now become the province of the right.
Yeah.
That social movement strategies and organizational norms have shifted. And one instance of this, not so much social movements, but political ones, is the way in which in the 2008 and 2012 presidential elections in the United States, clearly, the Democrats had the upper hand. And by 2016, the R word had it. And of course, January 6, 2021, I can imagine a world in which perhaps you and I might have seen that as a vigorous and legitimate moment of the politics of spectacle on the part of the left resisting a stolen election. I mean, perhaps not you and I individually, but people like us. Whereas we overnight became fans of the FBI, of law and order, of the DC police, of the congressional police, and of the idea of rejecting that particular politics of spectacle.
Yeah, I mean, wow, there's so much in that, Toby. I think your analysis is very sound about the ways in which the right and the authoritarian right in particular have learned to exploit the possibilities of internet culture, right? There was an assumption, I think, in a lot of scholarship in the first decade of this century, that what we had not yet really started to call social media, but the web and then web 2 and user-generated content and participatory culture and all these terms which kind of got collapsed into the master term social media, there was an assumption that all of these things together would give people new capacities to make meanings, new capacities to not just communicate, but to organize, right? Because internet technologies are those that allow any user in principle to say and make things and to share the things they've said and made. And all of this sharing and saying and making makes us or gives us the potential to be visible to other people who become visible to us in turn. So there was an assumption that we would all collaborate and organize and cooperate. That certainly turned out to be true, but the misapprehension that many of us, I include myself in this very much, were under was that somehow this would necessarily be progressive, or this kind of activity would necessarily benefit progressive forces. Many of us in the first decade of this century wrote as though this was somehow inevitable. I mean, my first book was a book called Future Active, came out in 2002, which was looking at the then terrain of internet activism and emerging web activism around tactical media and electronic civil disobedience and culture jamming. Now, the book didn't deny that darker forces might find uses for these things as well. I mean, I wrote about Pauline Hanson, who's an Australian political figure who has spent the last 26 or 27 years establishing a very dark legacy and changing Australian politics in very dark directions. I wrote about that. I wrote about kind of organizations that were trying to use the web as a successfully using the web as a tool for intimidating and indeed assassinating abortion providers in North America. So that stuff was clearly there, but many people, mea culpa, including myself, imagined, I think, that that the dominant benefit, the outcome of this was going to be to the benefit of progressive forces. That was clearly over-optimistic. There's a very good book which I'll plug by Joan Donovan, Emily Dreyfus, and Brian Friedberg called Meme Wars. I don't know, have you read that one?
No.
It's very much worth looking at. It traces how ideas and practices and ways of producing and sharing imagery, and basically memes and hashtags, if you like, as a way of organizing and communicating political contention. They trace the development of this primarily in the US from the Occupy Wall Street moment in 2011 through to the January 6th moment, 2021. And the arc of the story is how the right learned to exploit the kind of the tools of organizing the hashtag and meme approach to political networking, managed to learn how to adapt this.
Thanks for the reference. I always learn things from reading your work and also from our occasional conversations, and hugely today. My last question, Prof. G, before throwing to you to bring things to a conclusion, is I'm a botanist, I'm an economic historian, I'm a geographer. I'm on a committee considering Prof. G for the ultimate promotion. And I turn to my colleagues and I say, how the fuck does this dude know all this? So it's a boring question about method or theory or simply how do you go about things? Do you know what I mean? Because I think it is a legitimate question that's often turfed aside by people, especially in the humanities.
That's a tremendous question. It's actually something that it connects with something that I have thought about, because you get to a certain stage in your career, you start thinking that perhaps more of it is behind you than there is ahead of you, right? And you sometimes go through periods of stock taking or reflection. And I had one of those quite recently. And I thought, if I was asked, as you kind of just have, if I was asked to explain what it is that I do and how I do it, I would say this, which is that I try to write like a writer, and I try to teach like a teacher. And I'm struck that many people in academic life and university life don't try to do both those things. And there are many people who don't really try to do either of them. So a lot of my work comes out, a lot of my writing comes out of teaching. I take teaching very seriously. It's what I've always done. For 10, before my academic career, I spent 10 years teaching English in like five different countries. I've spent my entire adult life in classrooms with adults talking about things and trying to find ways of explaining things to people. And what I love about that is it's a learning experience for me every time. So everything that I write is always heavily informed by discussions that I've had with smarter, younger people in rooms who are telling me what's on their mind. And my opportunity is to make connections between ideas, because I've perhaps been doing it longer than they have. Perhaps making connections between ideas that come out in conversation, and find ways of developing those in order to provide people, ideally, I hope, offer people some kind of resources with which they can make better sense of media phenomena in their own lives. So it's very much not about me imposing. The new social media book, the one that came out 3 days ago, I address this in the introduction to the book. I say, who's social media? How can you speak to something as diverse and huge and diffuse as social media, right? Because my social media experiences will be different from yours, and they'll be different from those of any other potential reader of the book, right? Because of who we are, because of our nationality, our age, our education, our class, sexuality, all of these characteristics that shape how we experience daily mediated communication. And I try to talk through this in the introduction to the book, and saying this book is obviously an interpretation of the social media environment, but it's obviously not the only one, right? And my intention in the book and in the others that we've spoken about is to offer people resources that they can use to hopefully better understand their own social media experiences and their own social media environment, rather than me imposing mine on them as a reader.
That's a wonderful answer, Prof. And I'm smiling as I say that because my latest book just came out.
Oh, congratulations, Toby.
Thank you. But it clearly doesn't follow your precepts well enough, although much of my work does try to follow those precepts, because the publisher insisted that it be subtitled A Polemic.
Fantastic.
I may have stolen all the ideas from students, but I'm certainly got a wagging finger. And I'm doing a shed load of mansplaining in this book. So, but I really take your point, and actually it gets to the heart of one of the things that you and I were mentioning off air, my recent episode with Stuart Cunningham, at the end of which I say to him that I'm very worried about the people my age who haven't actually taught a big undergraduate class since the Cold War, and the people half my age who have never taught an undergraduate class and are professors, because they've been hived off into grant getting activities that mean that they simply don't have those decades of sitting down with sometimes people one's own age or older, but often younger, who know lots of things, as you say, that actually can inform, advise, instruct, entertain, energize the teacher, in inverted commas. And the fact that that is just lost as a resource really troubles me at the level of the quality of pedagogy, but the interaction also between pedagogy and research that, you're nodding as I say this, clearly is so important, to people such as ourselves.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. I've always thought that teaching and research are essentially the same thing. They're two sides of the same thing. They're both about the creation and the circulation of new knowledge, right? And off air before we started, we were talking about the inverted commas neoliberal university, right? And some of the currents that we've seen in our careers. It is, I think, very unfortunate. It's more than unfortunate. It's worrying that academic career paths and progression opportunities and opportunities for permanency or tenure or promotion are often connected with activities that, as you say, take the researcher away from the classroom. It's more prestigious. It's more prestigious as a university lecturer not to be doing any lecturing, right? What's that about? And I think that's a real concern. I absolutely agree with you.
And I think it's gotten worse in especially Britain and Australia with the decision that there are no such things anymore as polys, polytechnics. There are no such things as institutes of technology, no such things as College of Advanced Education. They're all universities. And suddenly, people who for decades taught without a doctorate, without the expectation of publishing, were thrust into a world where they were supposed to have and do both these things. And further generations of people at these places, in what was meant to be a breakdown of a class system, in fact, subsisting within what is still a class-based system, Oxbridge, the Russell Group in Britain, the so-called Sandstone Six, I think they're called in Australia, they
Is it still
still,
the group of eight?
right, okay, they are still the ruling class. Nothing's changed. But the pressure on people not to teach but to publish has increased amongst what were proletariat-serving institutions.
I have nothing to add to that. I was again nodding all the way through as you said it. I one of the things I admire about your podcast series is that people have the opportunity to actually talk about this intersection between teaching and research, and to talk about the direction of the university system in various parts of the world. It's a very value you're creating a very valuable space here, and thank you very much for letting me occupy some of it
Oh, well,
today.
thank you, Graham. Is there anything, Prof, that you'd like to add before we conclude?
No, you've been very generous with your time, and I'm conscious of your listeners' time as well. I've very much enjoyed having the opportunity to say what I have already, and I'm more than happy to end here.
Spoken like a true teacher who knows that class time is up. Thank you so much, Prof.
Thank you, Toby. An absolute pleasure. I hope we get to catch up soon.